Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, good to be with you on Sunday night. Ring your friends, tell them to come along and join us. There's an old song, you know, it says, "Friends and neighbours put a smile on the gloomiest face." Well, it's Neighbour Day around Australia. So I trust that today, sometime, somewhere, you've taken the opportunity to wear a smile and perhaps benefited from receiving one. Australia is much changed from the world in which many of us grew up. Religious and ethnic barriers in the past meant neighbourhoods were much more monocultural. Conformity was the norm. And as we are sometimes reminded, doors could be left unlocked and children left to look after themselves. But with these days, what in a virtual world does neighbourliness mean? Does it include my Facebook friends and my Twitter feed? Do the principles of neighbourliness apply to other communities and cultures? Does community still require some physical proximity? Well, tonight we're asking you to join us with your thoughts about your friends and neighbours, past and present. Have things changed much over the years? Do you still know most of the people in your street? What about the unit blocks and apartment towers? Is a tense meeting of the body corporate your only real interaction with your neighbours? Is it harder or easier being a neighbour today?
'Cause if you've friends and neighbours, that is something money won't buy. You can hold your head up high. Although you've not a penny, and your house may be tumbling down, with friends and neighbours, you're the richest man in town.
Ah, yes, you followed the bouncing ball all the way through, well, metaphorically at least, and you shuffled across the floor. With friends and neighbours, you're the richest one in town. It's Neighbour Day around Australia, but what these days in a virtual world does neighbourliness mean? Does it include your Facebook friends and your Twitter feed? Do the principles of neighbourliness apply to other communities and cultures? And does community still require some physical proximity? Well, joining us for our Neighbour Day panel tonight are the founder and principal friend of Neighbour Day, Andrew Heslop. Andrew's in our Canberra studio. Andrew, welcome. Great to have you back with us.
G'day, John. Thanks for the opportunity.
And on the line, on phone from Ballarat in the Victorian goldfields, wonderful historic Ballarat, a country town where neighbourliness also means digging into your history. Sue Yorston, the senior manager in social inclusion at Relationships Victoria. Sue, glad to have you with us.
Oh, thank you for having me on too. It's a pleasure to be here.
And with us in the studio in Sydney is Rabbi David Slavin, founder, among other things, founder and CEO of Our Big Kitchen. And we're going to hear a little more of that in a few minutes' time. David, welcome.
It's a privilege and a pleasure to be here with you, John.
Andrew, tell us first, you're the person we've got to hold responsible for this in its current incarnation. What is Neighbour Day and where did the idea come from?
Well, Neighbour Day is Australia's annual celebration of community, and it began 12 years ago in Melbourne after an elderly woman by the name of Elsie Brown was found dead in her home. And Elsie had been there for 2 years, and over that period of time, her neighbours had watched the piles of newspaper and store catalogues and mail pile up at the front door, but they hadn't made the connection between that evidence and something potentially being wrong for the elderly woman they knew who lived behind that door alone. And so it wasn't until March 2003 that one of her neighbours remembered that she hadn't seen Elsie for a considerable period of time. She called Victoria Police, who broke in and sadly discovered Elsie's remains wrapped up in a blanket upstairs on the sofa, where the coroner estimated she died sometime in January 2001. Mm-hmm. Very sad circumstance.
That story, Andrew, we've heard repeated in one variant or another several times over the last few years.
Very sadly, in Surry Hills in Sydney, not too long ago, a woman by the name of Natalie Wood, she was found after 8 years. And it was only because her sister-in-law insisted that the police and her lawyer try and track down what had happened to Natalie Wood. And they made the discovery, sadly, of what was left of Natalie Wood upstairs on her kitchen floor. But over those intervening 8 years, Sydney City Council, the utilities companies had turned up to try and find out why bills weren't being paid. And the neighbours just said, well, we think she's moved away. She'd always threatened to move in with her brother, and she clearly hadn't done that, or over up interstate. And so people just thought, well, the house has been left, and there it is. And sadly, there was a person behind there.
Now, what motivated you to say we've got to do something about this? I mean, lots of us have that casual thought, oh, that's a terrible pity. Somebody should do something. But you decided you should do something.
I did. And I'd been the National Communications Manager for Australian Red Cross. And I felt that there had to be some way that we could try and prevent a circumstance like Elsie Brown's death occurring again. So I wrote a letter to the editor of The Age, which they ran, and then your colleague in Melbourne, John Fain, rang me on Monday morning and said, this is such a great idea, I want to talk to you about it. And literally from there it has snowballed. 12 years later, people now get together for street parties and barbecues. They've had open days, they've had concerts today, fetes, you name it, people have done it, simply with the message of connecting with your neighbours.
Well, it's part of the charter responsibilities of a place like the ABC, Andrew. We're there to connect Australians one with another.
Well, it seems so. And I'm very glad, John did, because it is just amazing. As we all see in the paper every day, there's an idea about something new. Why don't we do this? As you said, why don't we do that? But this was an idea that just resonated with Australians, which I think is pretty good. When there has been no incentive other than a shared belief in safe, better connected suburbs and towns across Australia.
Now, it's taken off in other ways too, because you've garnered more and more support over the years. You've got now, sort of, you've been able to step back, you've got major community figures who've made great contributions themselves over the years, standing up as sponsors and ambassadors for Neighbour Day. This year, Fred Chaney is one. Mm-hmm. Who else have you got on the list?
Fred Chaney, the Senior Australian of the Year. Costa Georgiadis from Gardening Australia, he stepped up as well. So this year I handed over responsibility after running it and funding it myself for 12 years to Relationships Australia. There was an EOI process last year because I felt I had taken Neighbour Day as far as I financially and physically and probably intellectually could. It was time for some fresh air. But I thought about it long and hard, and I felt that there was huge support for it in the community. So rather than stop doing it, I thought I would pass the baton. And Relationships Australia stepped up and have done a cracker of a job in year one.
And that's a superb segue, of course, to Sue Yorston. Sue is Senior Manager of Social Inclusion for Relationships Australia. She's based in Victoria at Ballarat. And Ballarat, Sue, Ballarat's a wonderful town, it seems to me, for the sorts of endeavours we're talking about here.
Yes, it certainly is. It's Ballarat's growing enormously, and I think it's just sitting on 100,000 residents at the moment, but it's still, in its own way, remains a small country town. Everybody sort of knows everybody. I can't, you know, go down the street without talking to somebody that I know. So it still very much has that connection.
But neighbourliness in Ballarat too is something about a shared history, isn't it? Ballarat is very much built on the development of the nation, and in some ways it's a microcosm.
Well, very much so, and it's also always been, you know, sort of had that multicultural background as well, that you know, Ballarat grew rapidly from, you know, empty paddocks with a couple of farmhouses here and there to this very cosmopolitan town in a couple of years. And at its sat, I think, within 12 months or so, 25,000 residents from all over the world that came flooding in. So there was nationalities from everywhere.
That history, do people consciously own it around town in Ballarat?
Oh, very much so.
Is an important part of being a neighbour?
Very much so, very much so. As you might know, we have Sovereign Hill as well, and Sovereign Hill is an outdoor museum that has a really strong connection with Ballarat. It was started by a group of local people, and it has a strong volunteer service as well, so people giving up their time to go and be part of Ballarat. Ballarat, if you're talking about it being a microcosm, there's something on in Ballarat every weekend. And, you know, something that you can go to, something that you can attend. I don't think there's a weekend that there's not something on.
And, of course, you mentioned Ballarat, and that takes you to both the history of the goldfields and, of course, the political history with the Eureka Stockade. So it's a natural place to find a bit about who and what you are as an Australian.
Absolutely. It's also very strongly connected with the development of the Labor movement. There's a monument in the main street of Ballarat to, you know, that has on it 8 hours of work, 8 hours of play, and 8 hours of rest.
And I heard there was an extra tag on that: 8 hours for work, 8 hours for play, 8 hours for sleep, and 8 bob a day.
That'd be about right too.
Tell us about Relationships Australia's, well, first of all, what Relationships Australia exists for and how you decided to take on this great venture of Andrew's.
Well, probably Andrew can answer part of that better than I can, but Relationships Australia is very much about working with communities, with families, with individuals right around Australia, and certainly, as its name says, has that focus in relationships. So whether that's a couple relationship, whether it's a family relationship or a community relationship, we're about building and strengthening relationships in all their facets, in whatever that means for anybody.
So what do you look to get out or to put into Neighbour Day?
Well, I think for us it's about the connectedness. We know that, you know, for individuals who have a sense of connection, whether that be to the community that they live in, or might be in the street that they're in, it may be through work, it may be through friendships, whatever it is. But people who have a sense of connectedness to others fare better. Their mental health is better, they have problem-solving skills are better, their coping skills are better. It just has a runoff in a lot of different areas. It's what makes us feel good about ourselves, I think, in being able to be connected with other people. So Relationships Australia is very much sees that as neighbourhood, you know, the Neighbours Day as being a way of actually allowing us to stop and think about all that that means.
Well, I'm going to ask you all in a moment what neighbourliness means now and whether it's harder or easier to be a neighbour in this virtual world we're entering. But before we do that, it's a pleasure to introduce our third guest tonight, and that's Rabbi David Slavin, the founder and CEO, as I said, among other things, of Our Big Kitchen. David, this is an expression of neighbourliness, but first tell us what it is.
Well, Our Big Kitchen is a very special place that uses food as a language or as a medium to connect, to help, and to empower people, in a nutshell. For all the reasons that Andrew and Sue spelled out and that you've very eloquently put together on the introduction, neighbors don't necessarily know each other, and we've created a place where that can happen, where people can come together. And food is an incredible language to be able to achieve that.
It happens at one of those places which paradoxically can be a symbol of neighbourliness but also a symbol of isolation. One of the most popular tourist spots in the world, Bondi. Why there?
Why we chose Bondi was purely coincidental. That's the part of town that we were living in and the school that I was involved with when, like Andrew, felt there was a need to change a bit and to make some sort of positive contribution to the world around us. And it's true for any place, you know, whether it's Ballarat or whether it's Sydney. Smaller towns typically will find it easier for people to know each other. Larger cities, people, because of the large amounts of people walking through those cities, it's much easier for people to fall off the radar.
So what does My Big Kitchen or Our Big Kitchen do?
Well, Our Big Kitchen runs about 30 programs. It's all the same thing, just rehashed in a different way. It's all about cooking food, sharing food, and learning a bit more about food and giving people opportunities around food.
So I love food. How do I get connected?
There you go. So we do programs, birthday parties for children. We're doing corporate team building. We're doing people awareness for childhood obesity. We're part of the counter disaster plan. So if disaster strikes, we respond with the state, whether it's in the state or abroad. We're doing initiatives to the children's hospitals.
So tell us about your structure.
Structure is quite liquid, quite fluid, I should say, really, quite fluid. We have a very, very capable general manager by the name of Greg Fisher, who runs day-to-day operations. We have a staff of about 10 full-time people. We have about 10 or 15 small businesses that run out of the kitchen as well, and they become part of the Albi Kitchen family. We have school groups that, just to encapsulate what we do, I guess, so that listeners can have a bit of understanding. It's very much driven by the people who come in to use the kitchen. So we never want to be in a situation where we're telling somebody, I think you should help so-and-so. There are lots of charities, lots of community organizations who are saying that. We say, who do you want to help? We challenge them to help somebody, and we make the kitchen as a vehicle available to fill that social need that we hope they have.
Is this a physical location?
Oh, yeah, very much so. So if you walked into 36 Flood Street, you would find, and if you came in there blindfolded, you'd think you're in a five-star hotel's commercial kitchen. It's a 300-square-meter kitchen, fully equipped to the hilt with the latest technology and the latest equipment, and fully compliant with HACCP and with gold license, kosher, halal, the whole business.
And what happens? I walk in, I say, look, there's this lady down the street or there's a group of people who I think just need a bit of cheering up. And I think a meal would be a good thing. So what would you say to me?
Our first line of response is we have ready meals in the freezer and in the fridge, plenty of meals, and we'd give you some meals to take back to those people. You know, a neighbor's had a fall or a bad news or a family's fallen apart. Whatever the crisis is that happened. And generally, John, what happens is that the way we are wired as people is that when things are going well, they say you know who your friends know you. And when things are tough, you know who your friends are. All too often, the time that we most need friends is the time the friends are least there. And very often it's because the friends don't have the tools to be able to connect. They don't want to impose. They don't really feel comfortable unless they're really, really close friends. And all too often, people want to sound that they're in control of the situation and say, we'll be all right. So by having the kitchen, having food at your disposal because you're a part of the community, you walk into the kitchen, we'll give you some meals to take in there as a first response. And then we'll try to build a coalition of friends who you may want to bring in to cook for that person or for that need for a period of time.
And you're flexible in the dynamics about the way that's set up.
Extremely, extremely.
Well, there you are, friends around Australia. There's three of our neighbours in conversation this evening. Why don't you join us? Give us some observations. Do you think neighbourliness is as easy today as it was when you were a kid? How far back were you a kid? Were you a kid in the days when your mum could leave the door unlocked? Were you a kid in the days when, you know, it was easy to meet all your friends and neighbours underneath the lamplight at night? Do you remember those warm summer nights where all there was the street light at the bottom of the street and all the kids over the age of 10 met down there to plan their futures or meet their mates? Was it that for you? Neighbourliness and friendship. How important is the social glue? Do you know your neighbours? Are you somebody who the only time you meet your neighbours, because you're in the unit block, is it a very stressful body corporate meeting once a year? Yeah, I bet it is. 1-300-800-222. Do give us a call on Sunday night. Andrew Heslop, all three of you, David, join in, and Sue, you too. What are you finding is people's common experience these days in Australia? That is there a cri de coeur that we are losing a sense of neighbourliness?
Well, I think that Dovid, in his creation of Our Big Kitchen with his wife Leia, has in fact reinterpreted community, because he's found this space and fitted it out in the most amazing way you could imagine. And it is a happy place. It is always a happy place. And his infectious humanity is just wrapped around that space. So I've been in a couple of times to watch a number of groups putting together those meals that he talked about, people from a range of different faiths, working side by side, happily and together, for the good of the community. And this is just a fantastic insight into, I think, somebody taking an idea and going, how can I make this bigger and better and bring in a range of people to support me? But I think often we're too scared to think about our neighbours. We're you know, living very busy lives with our careers, with our families, with our kids going off to sport and other responsibilities, that we kind of don't worry about the neighbours until there's a disaster or emergency. And it's terrific that Dovid and the kitchen are available as, you know, as part of counter disaster planning. But one of the things that Neighbour Day has talked about all this time is the sense of, don't wait until there's a disaster or emergency to get to know your neighbour. You know, that we don't need to wait for a bushfire or a flood or something terrible to happen. So that's why today has been a great catalyst to break down those barriers and encourage people to go next door or across the street or on the next farm and say, g'day, this is who I am. Why don't you come over for a cup of tea?
Sue Yorston, does neighbourliness or even any sort of relationship really still require some degree of physical proximity? That is, there's something about the touch and feel of the other person.
Well, that's a difficult question, because we're coming into a new era now where we've got generations now that are growing up with, you know, a lot of screen time, and their relationships are often built around that, the screen time. So there's less personal face-to-face interactions, I think, than we've ever seen in any generations previously. But it's through our, it's through that eye contact, it's through reading the body language and hearing the tone of the conversation that we pick up our cues about what it is that's going on for each other. So, for instance, if I sent you a text message and said, "Hi, John, how are you?" and you messaged back and said, I'm okay, Sue," I would just read that as, "I'm okay, Sue." But actually, if I was looking at you and said, "How are you, John?" and you said, "I'm okay," but I can see by looking at you that you're not, then I'm prompted to say, "I don't know that you are okay, John. What's going on? You don't look so good." So I think we lose something if we don't have that personal interaction and face-to-face contact.
Rabbi Dovid, that surely too is part of the essence of the Big Kitchen, to get people interacting.
Yes, I think it's both the point that Andrew and Sue make is very, very valid. And despite our ability to interconnect with each other much, much more easily, I'm sure all of you have passed by a bus stop and seen 5 or 10 or 20 people all standing side by side, all texting and looking at their own things with their earphones, totally, totally, you know, detached from one another.
Because it's a way of disengaging,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. Really, what has been created initially to engage with people turns out has a really flip side to it. And listen, internet's not going away. Quite to the contrary, there'll be more and more of it. It's here and it's here to stay, and we have to learn how to live with it. But there is something which is irreplaceable, as Sue mentioned, and this is really an incredible credit to Andrew for tapping into this incredibly important void. We're very blessed in a country like Australia. We don't have the real need that perhaps other countries have to know your neighbor, because it's so much easier to just run onto a convenience store to get a couple of eggs or to get a tub of milk rather than to go and bother the neighbor. So some places, or in Australia at a different time, that was very, very easy. So we just need to be happy that we're at a stage that we don't have the real need that once drove us to be together, but at the same time to identify that with that real need came those issues that Sue touched upon in terms of being able to look at people And what Andrew has in fact done and said, fine and well to have the latest gadgets and to the latest apps and to Andrew is actually pretty switched on when it comes to IT. That's part of his day job, which will leave for a different time and a different place. But he also acknowledged that a neighbor is irreplaceable because we, when trouble comes, or the first person you'll see to say hello to and a good morning, and just to be there for each other, is going to be the neighbor who lives physically close to you.
How well do you know your neighbors? How often do you spend time with them? And do you particularly like it? 1-300-800-222. Give us a call on Neighbour Day. Our guests on Sunday night are Andrew Heslop, the founder of Neighbour Day, and somebody who carries the torch still, Rabbi David Slavin, founder and CEO of Our Big Kitchen at Bondi in Sydney, and Sue Yorston, senior manager in social inclusion for Relationships Australia in Ballarat. Time to take some calls from you, and Don in Parks is first on the line. Hello, Don, how are you, and thank you for joining us.
Very good. I'm a 74-year-old gentleman from who's a retired farmer. I've moved into Parks. And if you're helpful to the people either side of you, you can make a start. It's quite simple. Like one of the chaps, one side of me, you know, has been very helpful to me. He always waves to me. He has even made my front lawn once when I was a bit slow to it. And the other couple is people who've just had a baby. But still, they're very helpful to me. And I'm sure if I was in a problem as a 74-year-old, 75-year-old, I could ask them to help me. And that I'm confident about. Of course, I'm still fairly capable of doing this. I've still got a license to drive the car and so forth. But neighbours, if you're decent to them, they come to you.
Don, you've come into town from a property, I take it.
Yes.
Have you found the adjustment from living on a farm to living close together difficult, or have you found it easy?
I found that if I've got involved with the church and the Anglicare shop and helping with picking up donated furniture and things like that, because I've got a Toyota Hilux and things like that, I can be useful there. And really, I believe if you are open and are prepared to make an effort to be with people, you get response.
Absolutely.
And that's my suggestion.
Don, how old were you when you moved into town, Don?
72.
So it's really never too old to make new friends.
That's right. Exactly. And I've got so many widows around me. Unfortunately, my wife was killed in an accident 4 years ago. And I do have to make new friends. And it's worked well for me. People are respectful to me if I'm decent to them. And that's my suggestion to the wider population. If you look to being pleasant to people, you'll get a response. And look, I don't want to take the time of a lot of other people who will be calling, so leave it at that, won't you? And, you know, I'm happy to have been able to make this suggestion.
A great contribution, Don.
Don, I just want to jump in for one second. Yeah. Firstly, it's always a privilege to talk to the farmers of this incredible country and to say thank you for your hard work, number one. And always when we talk to the rural Australian, to the farmers, one of the proudest moments of Our Big Kitchen was at a very difficult time during the drought. We had a lot of people, a lot of city folk coming in, baking care packets and sending it out to the farmers as a small token of their appreciation, because for all year, all the produce is coming from you. This was a little chance for us to add value to some of that stuff and send it back to you. So keep up your great work, Don, and continue being a great neighbor.
Well, thanks very much for that. I've got wonderful friends from out at the farm as well. But now that I'm in town, you know, they're still on the farm, so I have to make new friends. And I, as I said, if you're pleasant to people, you'll get a response.
Don, that's great.
Absolutely. Yeah. I just wanted to pick up on what Don was saying too. I was thinking of where I'm living at the moment in Ballarat. I've come in off a property as well. And, you know, where your neighbour might be, you know, 10 k's down the road. And it's very different living in a city sort of environment where your neighbours are next door. But I have an elderly neighbour living next door to me, and I come home and my lawns are done. They're just done.
He's had the
mower out and he's done his, and he looks at mine and thinks they need doing as well. So he just goes ahead and mows the lawn. He brings my rubbish bins in, and he, you know, mows on the verge about three houses along, so that everybody, it just happens. You don't ask for it, just happens. But it's really what Don is saying, I think, in being able to, it starts with ourselves, it starts with each one of us. And I wonder if we maybe have taken the privacy side of things a little bit too far, that we're very averse to going and knocking on someone's door and saying, hi, I've just moved in, or whatever. We're a bit nervous about the reception that we may receive, and we're also very mindful, I think, of who those neighbours may be, and maybe in a negative way apply some assumptions to that. So what I mean is that we're very... I think you mentioned earlier, John, about when you were a kid, and I certainly had the same experience where I lived in a street with about 20 houses, and I lived in all of those houses. I just wandered in and out of them. The kids just moved between the houses with no thought about whether it was, you know, any safety issues or who we were talking to. It was just so much more open and relaxed. There wasn't the traffic on the road, so we could play cricket on the road because there wasn't the cars that there are today. So we live in a very different, fast-moving environment, but we're also very, very conscious of who it is that we're talking to, and especially who we let our children talk to. And that can have an adverse effect as well, because children also need to experience a lot of different people and have lots of different people in their life in order to live a rich life.
Don, thank you for your call. And Sue, of course, it was also the time when your mum would send you next door for half a cup of sugar, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And my mother had the same, you know, women living in those houses for years and years and years and years. And since when I was born, in the house that I was born, my mother died when she was 74. Oh, and the reason that we knew that she had died was because her window didn't go up. So these three women who lived opposite each other had this little thing where when they got up in the morning, they put their front window up a little bit. And when that window went up, they each knew that the other was all right. And this particular morning, my mum's window didn't go up. So the neighbour rang me.
That's sort of private intimacy, that, isn't it?
It is.
At a very sophisticated level.
Yes.
Very simple, very sophisticated. Don, thank you for your call. You've given us a terrific start. Let's say hi to Jim on the Hume Highway. Hello, Jim. How are you?
Good, mate. Yourself, how are you?
Yeah, great.
That's all right. I come from a large extended family of... my mother had 11 children, and there was mainly all boys, but we had nothing to do, and we lived in an area where there was just one park and an oval. That was all there was. And we found that the area was getting overpopulated really, really quick. So once a year, what Mum done was send out flyers to all the houses around the area, if we knew them, if we didn't know them, whatever, saying, hey, look, let's have this street and this street congregate down at the park and have a big cricket match. and stuff like that, free barbecue, free drinks, and all this stuff. Mate, the first year, I think we got about 5,000 or 6,000 to come down. But after about 3 or 4 years of doing that, we had the whole neighbourhood down there. And, mate, I'm telling you, we didn't even know people that were turning up and going, oh, where do you live? Oh, I live there. We lived next door to one for 10 years and we didn't even know it existed. And it was amazing. And all the kids mingled, all the adults. It was just, really. But these days, you don't see any of that. You ride a push bike around, you don't know who's going to approach you. You don't know anything like that these days. You can't take your eyes off your kids or anything.
I think what that shows is, you know, it reinforces the slogan for Neighbour Day, which is the community you want starts at your front door. Yeah. And as Jim's mum proved, it just takes one person to say, hey, hang on, why don't we do this? And increasingly, more and more people will join, which is terrific. And that's really what it's about.
Do you think, I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but it still has some resonance, and some, I think it's more true than some people want to acknowledge, that this did in fact begin, the sort of problems people are alluding to, with television, because television delivered into your house at a very cheap rate, entertainment which you would be paying, you know, $1,000 an hour for if you could even afford vaguely any mm-hmm. of it.
And that's why we have to be very clever and very strategic about how we use the internet, how we use Facebook and Twitter and all of those other social media applications to redirect people back into their community by just remembering that those are just channels of communication, but they can't replace and they will never replace the intimacy of a face-to-face conversation and all of the emotions that come with that, as Sue talked about. You know, we often blame the internet for so many of society's ills, but, you know, we're all in charge of the internet. We've just got to make it work for us.
Yeah, we push the button.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it.
Let's have hello to Bill at Avondale Heights in Melbourne, one of those classic suburbs of the 60s, Bill.
I wasn't there in the 60s, Footscray boy, 1935, but came here about 1990, but I was fortunate to carry the torch in 2000 and finished up with about 500 people in the backyard from 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. when I kicked them out. And what got me motivated was the number of people, when they introduced themselves to each other, they found out they'd been neighbours for 5 years and didn't bloody know each other. So we have a street committee. We have our annual, we're fortunate, we've got a little council park in the middle of the street. And every year we get about 70% turn up. We supply a barbecue and a soft drinks and whatever and a bit of BYO. And but the other thing too is, just on a personal note, three of my immediate neighbours, I'm 78 and I've got a big black lab that lives in the house with me, three of my neighbours have got my keys. And if they don't see me about, they're authorised to come and open up and look after the dog.
Never mind about you.
No.
That's a great story, and that's a really good strategy, so that your community is connected with you. And as I think one of the earlier callers was saying about having, you know, that routine of the blind or the window going up at a particular time of day, that has and continues to change and save many lives. There's a program for elderly or vulnerable people from Australian Red Cross called Telecross, and that's a telephone call once a day by a volunteer that says, you know, are you okay? And if you don't answer within a defined period of time, then they have contact details for your, you know, partner, your child, whoever, your neighbour, someone who has a key, and then they can be activated to come and check up that you're okay.
We'll take another couple of calls while we're on this little topic. But before we do, I'm going to ask Rabbi David, about the interfaith, multi-faith dimensions of this stuff. Because quite often, particularly a country like Australia, which has a pretty monocultural tradition up until the 1950s, and the Jewish community were always part of Australia, but Jewish community was a bit like the Catholic community in its time, a community that, right up until television came along, could largely exist within its own world. And neighbourliness was a thing that each of those communities, whether it's the Catholic community or the Jewish community, were completely self-contained, cradle to grave. That has broken down enormously, but has that had some advantage in that a little bit of more cross-cultural stuff has been able to build?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a great deal of sensitivity to cultural inclusion that we're seeing. There is a natural tendency for people to want to stick to their own because it's more comfortable, it's easier, less questions need to be asked and much less answered. But at the same time, and it's, again, human nature, you come to a cocktail party, the people who you know are the people you gravitate to, you spend the whole night talking to them, and that's it. You don't make new friends, you don't make any, that's just who we are, because we don't necessarily want to, most of us at least. But we have, in fact, and that's a very good point, and I thank you for that question, because what we've done has been spent a lot of time, especially encouraging people, and particularly young people, who would never meet each other, to come, Jewish and Muslim kids, who each have very prefixed ideas about the other. They aren't normally nice ones, okay? And when these kids come
and
in...
And kids can be pretty explicit about that,
extremely,
can't they?
Extremely. But at the same time also, you know, children always rather be happy than being right. They're always happy within a short period of time to be there. And the beauty about the food is it takes this relationship to the next level. On the one hand, which means suddenly you have something to do together. It's not just you're meeting and talking and finding out things about each other, but you're in fact cooking for a greater cause, feeding the homeless, feeding the needy, and we're doing this together. Singles who are cooking together for the needy. So we aim to bring. Now we've had consul generals from different countries, the American, the Pakistani, and the Indian, all cooking together in the one place with us. But it gives people the opportunity to put their differences aside while they're cooperating on something which is more positive. So who I am becomes much less relevant than what we're doing here together. So please pass the knife, or please taste what I've made, please add to it. And that gives people the opportunity to come. So we brought Indian and Pakistani kids together. We're constantly bringing different, and we specially mix. We'll be mixing people able-bodied and people who are disabled. We have inmates that come in who are working with free people. So it's a place that we actively encourage for people who normally wouldn't meet each other to be able to do so.
Well, saying thanks to Bill at Avondale Heights for his street party initiative, it's now saying hi to Karen at Gordon in the ACT, who wants to pick up something that Rabbi David alluded to just in that last little bit. Lisa.
I recently moved from a semi-rural area due to domestic violence into town, and I've got my three girls with me, and we've moved into a lovely cul-de-sac area, and the neighbours are spectacular. We're in a cul-de-sac. There's up to 14 children in the area, ranging from about 2-year-old up to grade 12, and they all play together. They all get out there and have a nice time while on maybe a Friday or a Sunday night, all the parents stand around and have a beer. So the neighbourhood is lovely.
Now, you mentioned also when you spoke to our producer something about the School of the Air.
Yes, all of my children did School of the Air because of the semi-rural area that we were in. And the three girls that I've got with me had never been to school before. And we're talking grade 8, grade 7, and grade 1.
Was there a sense of community built up through School of the Air?
Absolutely.
Have they maintained those friendships?
They have, to tell you the truth. My eldest daughter, who's 19, is now living in Mount Isa with a fellow schoolmate that she met from Mount Garnet, and they've been together for 3 years.
So virtual communities can have productive results.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Good on you, Lisa.
And even my 21-year-old son met his girlfriend through friends who all went to School of the Air.
It's an interesting observation, Andrew, about the way we can construct communities and be mutually supportive of each other, that the technology can be turned to an advantage.
Well, up until now, I'd never considered School of the Air being the original social media, but I guess that's exactly what it was, a great Australian invention that connected children across vast distances with a teacher who was also separated from them, maybe in a capital city, maybe in a base somewhere in the outback. But that sense of we're all in this together, how can we work together to, in this case, you know, learn, really has been a unique Australian experience. Is it something your children, Lisa, value now that they're a little bit older?
I believe so, because they keep a lot of the contacts with a lot of the people that they went to school with. We're in Cairns, as I said, and, you know, they still have gone to 21st up on the Cape, or up on the tableland, or 18th birthdays all over the place, and they all still keep in contact.
Fantastic story. Thank you, Lisa, so much for joining us. Good on you.
Thank you.
To Karen now, we've found Karen in the ACT. Hello, Karen, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, thanks for being with us. Now, you've got a couple of observations you wanted to make.
Yeah, well, we had an excellent Good Neighbour Day last weekend, because this weekend didn't suit the community, but my son and two other young men who have disabilities are all part of an intentional community in public housing, and it's been a fantastic environment for them and for the other members of the complex. Yeah.
Just explain to us what an intentional community is.
Well, it was a community that was set up around three young men who have a disability, and the other members of the community were invited to join with the knowledge that they were providing informal support and were, you know, committed to being good neighbours. So for me, as Daniel's mother, it means that he lives semi-independently in his own house in the complex, but I have the phone numbers of, you know, 12 other families that I can ring up and ask for them to go and check on him if he needs some additional support.
How does that make you feel as a mum, Karen, knowing that your son has an extended community there to support him?
Look, it's been fantastic. It's changed his life. He's far more confident, far more open. Just, you know, his life has expanded enormously.
Has it changed your life?
Oh, of course. He's only been out of home for a bit over 12 months now, and, you know, I can freely leave his house, knowing that should he ring me with some sort of emergency, that there'll definitely be someone around that can, you know, help him out.
Terrific example. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for that, Karen. There's time to take one other call. I'd like to speak to Sarah in Bombarderry. Hello, Sarah, how are you?
Good evening, how are you?
Yeah, fabulous.
My call, John. This has been an awesome conversation on neighbourliness, and so many things I want to say. I'll try and keep it quick. I have a significant vision impairment, have a guide dog. My husband and I moved from Sydney down to the Shoalhaven in December last year. I've lived in regional centres before, and I found the capital city was a lot colder and a lot more difficult to physically and relationally navigate than down here. Only been here 4 months this coming Tuesday, and for me, whether it's people at church or people in the local shops or our neighbours or the kindy next door on the other side or the disability community across the road or the church in walking distance up the street, everybody's fantastic. And whether it's getting involved with the church up the street or the church over the bridge in Nowra, people have been really friendly, genuinely friendly, interested, engaged, made me feel welcome, and my guide dog, from the moment I walked in the door. Same with my husband and his golfing. And it is lovely. Community still happens. And regarding online community I've found works when people who have gotten to know each other make the leap from the online community into real community over the phone, face-to-face. I've made long-lasting, amazing friendships with women in Australia and all around the world through the net, and it becomes really powerful when you can, so to speak, jump off the screen and onto the phone or together face-to-face.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for the observation, Sarah. Terrific of you. We've only got a minute or so now before we wind up, and we'll probably wind up with another chorus of that song to take us out in just a moment or two, friends and neighbours. But before we do that, I'm going to ask each of our studio guests this evening, Andrew, Sue and Rabbi David, to tell us what for them is the key element that they'd say to people, look, if you're going to do one thing about neighbourliness, do this. David first.
Oh, great. I just want to thank Andrew for an incredible initiative and for flying Australia's flag all the way down to the UN and telling the world who we really are as a country. That's number one. One thing that comes to mind, going back to the question I was asked earlier by yourself, John, and that is, in terms of religions, have within them the ability to isolate people. You know, Passover, which is a major Jewish holiday, is in 2 weeks' time on the 14th. We begin the Seder, we begin the evening by inviting anybody to come and join us. That is how the evening begins.
Now, there's a challenge to the community. Sue, briefly.
Just very briefly, it doesn't take much to say g'day.
Wonderful.
Be the first person to do it.
And Andrew?
Be the change that you want to see in your community.
There you are, folks. Some good advice for some friends and neighbours on Sunday night. Thank you for joining us, and we'll pick up the conversation later on in the chat room with Frank Sheehan. You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. Thanks to Rabbi David Slavin, Andrew Heslop, the founder of Neighbour Day, and Sue Yorston of Relationships Australia.
'Cause if you friends and neighbours, that is something money won't buy. Yeah.